Call the State and Federal Affairs Committee to order. June 22nd, 2005. We're not going to do the bills in order. We've got a couple things we've got to straighten up. We'll go through them. First, we have the need for a bill introduction.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we ask Legislative Council to draft the sign and die bill.
Representative Boquist has moved that we have Legislative Council draft a sign and die bill. Any objections? So ordered. Sounds like we're ready to go home, don't it? We have a senator and a state rep that we need to get out of here, so we're going to open a hearing and work session first on Senate Bill 699A. Can you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 699 is one which will prohibit the annexation or incorporation of certain lands, industrial land, in specified sections of Jackson County. Specifically, these are referred to in the measure as the unincorporated area of White City and the area west of within Medford's urban growth boundary on the west of Highway 99. It specifies that if any annexations of those lands are to occur, that any development rights that existed at the time of the annexation will be retained. It contains a sunset clause of June 30, 2016, and the measure will become effective upon a passage. It passed on the Senate side. I'd like to note 29 with one excused.
Okay. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'd like to make a couple quick comments first that relate probably more to what you just said. You said we have a senator and representative we need to get out of here. We actually have 30 senators and 60 representatives need to get out of here. And also, when you draft your bill, I'd like to see the date on it. I could give you some suggestions. Having said all that, this is a bill which is extremely important to our district and to Southern Oregon. This bill relates primarily to an industrial park that we have presently in the county. We want to keep that park to be competitive. We want to keep those jobs there. We want to bring new business to that area. And we are concerned that White City, which in fact is not a city, but is called White City, presently has an urban growth boundary that includes that industrial area. They levied fees against the industrial park to help improve their area, and has brought actually no real value to the industrial park itself. There is a very real concern that White City, in fact, will incorporate and become a city for the sole purpose of annexing this area and thereby bringing revenue back to the city with no value, again, to the business owners and the businesses in that area. Included also in this is a section that affects a business called Harry and David's, which I'm sure you've heard of. They are in an unusual situation in which their plant, which is a large one, sits half in the city and half in the county. The county line and the city line run right straight through the middle of the plant. They are concerned about annexation also. I'd like to point out the city of Medford has been a good partner in this and has not ever expressed any desire to go forward with annexation of the rest of the plant. Again, it's the same principle, however. This is one probably we're going to be looking at statewide. You've also already heard and have a very controversial bill involving Nike. But it's the same type of issue. Cities trying to annex industrial areas which bring in revenue without bringing any value to those industrial areas, and sometimes even skipping over large areas in which they would have costs incurred to bring in sewers or police protection or things of that nature. So that, in very simple terms, that is what the bill tries to do. And I would turn to my good colleague, Representative Richardson, to give his views on the bill also.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the concerns that we have in Southern Oregon is jobs, of course, and these companies that would be affected by unconsented to annexation provide hundreds of jobs. They also have plants across the country and in other nations, and as they look ahead for 5 or 10 years, they have to make decisions as where they're going to put resources for expansion. And so they want to make sure that if they're going to put expansion in Southern Oregon, that they're not going to have unexpected increases of costs for services that they don't need. And so this bill would help assure that they know that they can plan on how their resources will be used and the future for the status property-wise of their companies. And so it's very important for our economy that these businesses be able to have an influence and a permission before they would be annexed.
Okay. Any questions, the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we send Senate Bill 699 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 699A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion objections? Call the roll, please.
President Barker.
Aye.
President Boquist.
Aye.
President Barker.
Aye.
President
McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Well, 699A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Richardson, would you carry the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. So there will be two bills taken off the agenda today, 2009-2010. They'll be held over. Open a work session on Senate Bill 489A.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 489A.
Representative Boquist has moved to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 489A.
Senate Bill.
489A is a non-discussion on the issue. Want to call the roll, please?
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Motion passes. And Mr. O'Leary, can you tell us about the conflict amendments?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, following passage on the 13th of this bill with the A3 amendment, LC alerted us that there was a conflict as a result of Senate Bill 600, which is the bill that updates and reorganizes the PUC chapter of the ORS, which is the same chapter that this bill would amend. That bill, Senate Bill 600, was signed by the governor last week. The A4 amendment that is before you now makes the conforming changes consistent with that issue and resolves the conflict. The A4 also contains the information about the stay and the process for a stay that was in the amendment that you voted out last week.
Okay. Representative Dalto, did you want to comment on the amendments? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 489.
Representative Boquist has moved the dash A4 amendments into Senate Bill 489. Any discussion, objections? Not so ordered, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 489. Thank you. Work session on House Bill 2147. Public hearing.
Thank you, ma'am.
Jim Carlson. James Taylor? Is it correct?
Taylor. Oh, thanks, James.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Association. You have in front of you some dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2147, which is clarifying some legislative intent of the nursing facility provider tax law that was passed last session. It's addressing a number of technical issues, a couple drafting errors, and making a number of changes requested by the Department of Human Services. We've worked very closely with the Department of Human Services to come to agreement on this set of amendments, and have worked very closely with both the House Budget Committee chair and the Senate Budget Committee chair in support of these. You've got a very good staff measure summary in front of you and a one-page section-by-section analysis that gets into what the amendments do, and I'd be happy to respond to any specific questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Hayes from the Department of Human Services, and I'll just echo Jim's comments that we're in accord with this. The only note I want to make is that before the next biennium or in the next biennium, the rate-setting methodology sunsets as part of this bill as well. So during the interim, we will have to work with the industry to develop a rate-setting methodology that we can bring in as part of the governor's recommended budget and then apply it to the eventual sunset next biennium. So it's going to take a lot of work for us to structure this appropriately for you to act on next biennium, but I think both we and the industry are committed to doing that. With that, I think we're okay.
Mr. Chair, one last thing I wanted to note for members of the committee. Because we do deal with a sunset issue on the existing law by pushing that into 08 on a one-year extension on this, Legislative Council did that in these amendments so that we would not, if we waited to next session to deal with the sunset issue, so we would not end up with a 90-day gap in the ability to collect the provider tax assessments. And so as a result of that change on that sunset date, this will require a three-fifths vote on House and Senate floors, which leadership all the way around is aware of and has checked off on, but this will not have the effect of increasing revenues that are raised. This will actually have the effect of refunding about $1.3 million worth of retroactive tax assessments that were collected or are to be collected for the year of 03-04, and that has been approved and anticipated by the House and Senate budget co-chairs.
Any members have any questions, comments? Need a motion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, seeing we're in work session, I move House Bill 2147 be amended with the Dash 8 amendment.
The Representative Volquist has moved the Dash 8 amendments into House Bill 2147. Any discussion, objections? Okay, there on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2147 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Volquist has moved House Bill 2147 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Volquist.
Aye.
Representative Lloyd.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. House Bill 2147 as amended moves the floor with a do pass. Mr. Carlson, would you work with Representative Flores as the carrier on the floor speech so it's clear to the people?
Please? Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, who does this one?
Are we done?
We're going to wait for the administrator to get it.
Bill.
Pap Store.
When I know it first.
And MacArthur. Okay. Open a hearing and work session on House Bill 2908. Can you tell us about the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This bill, the original bill, required the Oregon Transportation Commission to consider specified factors for designating a highway as a freight route. We have received Dash 1 amendments from the City of Gresham. Those amendments would replace the measure and designate all county roads, highways, and related facilities within the corporate boundaries of the City of Gresham and Multnomah County to be within the exclusive control and jurisdiction of the City of Gresham. It excludes control of such roads, highways, and related facilities from the jurisdiction of the Multnomah County Court and directs Multnomah County to annually transfer to the City of Gresham a percentage of county transportation revenues equal to the share of county road and highway lane miles affected by the measure.
Okay, I'm going to call up two people first and one later, Ron Papsdorf and John Dorst, please. Identify yourselves and tell the story.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ron Papsdorf. I represent the City of Gresham. Sorry, I have some.
And I'm John Dorst, Deputy Director of Environmental Services for the City of Gresham. Thank you.
Whichever one of you wants to start, go ahead.
I'll make some very brief comments, and then Mr. Dorse is available to answer any technical questions the committee might have. Basically, committee members, the Dash 1 amendments that are before you today to House Bill 2908 is a good government bill. It's about aligning urban services within the city of Gresham. Requires the transfer of Multnomah County roads within the city of Gresham to the city of Gresham. It eliminates a great deal of duplication in transportation service provision within the city. This issue dates back to the mid-1980s. In 1984, Multnomah County transferred all urban services, including transportation, to the city of Portland. Within Portland, the city of Gresham has been pursuing a similar arrangement ever since that time, and as a matter of last resort, we're here seeking this amendment, given that we have not been able to negotiate a fair and equitable agreement with Multnomah County. We are a unique situation in terms of the amount of roadway miles within the city limits that are owned and operated by Multnomah County, and the percentage of total road miles within the city that are owned and operated by the county. So we are a unique situation in the state. Our business community, our Chamber of Commerce, our citizens are asking for this alignment of services so that we can provide good, cost-effective, and responsive services to our citizens and businesses. As a full-service city, we are best suited to provide these types of urban services. It's consistent with county policy as they've adopted in the past that says that they should focus on countywide services like assessment and taxation, libraries and corrections, and urban services should be provided by cities. This makes the most effective use of taxpayer dollars, and we urge your support for these amendments.
Third, please.
I think consistent with what Ron said, I think the only thing is we also are looking at the Spring Water and Pleasant Valley and some of those areas, adding those to the urban growth. And development of those, trying to coordinate multiple jurisdictions, as we last session promised that we would get Spring Water and those things done. It is most effective if we can do it with, you know, a single government, and that's highly important to us.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Yeah, Mr. Papstorf, in effect, what you're asking us to do here is to preempt or override a process that apparently has not been successful at coming to a negotiated agreement with the county. Could you give us just a little bit more of the history about, you know, how this thing was developed and where those negotiations broke down? Because obviously we would prefer to see a consensus kind of product come forward rather than one where one side's asking us to make a decision over the protest of the other.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, you're absolutely right, and believe me, our first preference would be to be able to negotiate a fair and equitable arrangement with the county. We've been working to try to do that for many, many years, and I think the breakdown has been that the county is a little too close to the situation. It's, I think, a little bit difficult to kind of let go of something that you have, irrespective of how appropriate it is or how it fits with your stated policy direction. And I think, quite frankly, it comes down to, in some ways, resources and some fears that they may not be able to provide services to their remaining system. However, when we look at that situation, the second clause of these amendments amounts to roughly about 25% of their net transportation resources, leaving 75% for the remaining rural system, which is very consistent with other counties around the state. And there are many counties in around the state that have a similar mileage of rural road system that Multnomah County would remain having.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Mike MacArthur, please.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. I've been asked to speak today on behalf of Multnomah County, who couldn't be here. Multnomah County opposes the amendment that you just heard. Multnomah County informs me that the process is in place to transfer these roads to City of Gresham by January 1st, 2006. By the county's made that decision. It's in process. Commissioner Maria Rojo de Steffi is the lead negotiator for the city. Apparently, there were negotiations scheduled. The city canceled those recently. The city is in favor of this. They ask that you allow them to be able to work that out. Mr. Chair, I find something curious in the amendment. Reference to the Multnomah County Court. I'm not sure what that means. There are only about 7 or 9 counties operating with county courts anymore in the state, and I don't believe there is one in Multnomah County. Anyway, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions, I can refer them to Multnomah County.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
let me
just follow up on that, Mr. MacArthur. The county court is the sort of traditional name for the rural, and I think it survives in some of the rural counties. Is it? Are you saying that if with this language, that this would not would be an inaccurate description of what the governing body is of Multnomah County?
Chair Krieger, Representative Pearson, I formerly was a county court judge in Sherman County and knew a little bit about this. Most of the counties in Oregon have gone away from the county court. Multnomah County, by adopting a charter, certainly has. So I just find it curious that there's this reference here. I don't know what it means.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2908 be amended with a -1 amendment.
Representative Volquist has moved the -1 amendment into House Bill 2908. Any objections, discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, the point that's just made about the reference to the county court, just on its face, it doesn't look like it's an accurate description. So I guess I'm concerned with the language of the amendment, and I realize we're late in the session, but I just think the amendment isn't quite in shape as yet. So I would have to object to the amendment.
Do either Mr. Papsdorf or Mr. Dorse want to address that issue specifically?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Ron Papsdorf, representing the City of Gresham. We're not breaking new ground with this pursuing statutory language. City of Salem and Amity have gone this route as well. We did look at that existing statutory language for guidance on how to craft this. Would be our belief that this language does accomplish the desired transfer of the transportation facilities.
So they're hijacking the bill.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, you want your bill, right?
We're just going to stand at ease for a minute until we get some legal counsel information, please.
2908 with a dash one.
Any objections to the motion? If not, what we need to do is have legislative council take a look at the wording and get an amendment to the bill, and then we'll bring it back. So we'll close the work session on 2908. And that'll be, what, a day or two before we get that, Cletus?
Yes.
Okay. Where's Representative Barnhart? Can you get together with Representative McPherson regarding your portion of the bill, see if that can be salvaged, and then take a look at the wording if you have any concern about the amendment?
Okay.
Session on House Bill 3021.
Chair and Committee, HB 3021 allows ballot to list names of all political parties that have nominated candidate for election. This measure was referred to the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs from the House Committee on Elections and Rules. Currently under Chapter 254 of the Oregon Revised Statute, the name of each candidate and the nominated shall be printed upon the ballot or ballot label in one place without regard to how many times the candidate may appear or be nominated.
Okay, Representative Krupp.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. Very briefly, this is a bill that a friend of mine, Richard Burke, who will be testifying in a moment, the Libertarian Party, has been chatting with me about for some time, actually a number of years. And I thought that this was an appropriate idea. Let me share with you why. In this last particular elective cycle, I was not only the Republican nominee, but a number of Democrats wrote me in the primary, and I became the Democrat nominee, in which I accepted their nomination. At the same time, when the voter's pamphlet is printed, it only lists me as the Republican nominee. And I think it is a fair idea to demonstrate that an individual has received support from a number of parties, that should be listed, because it is a fact. It is recorded as such in the Secretary of State's office. It, however, is not allowed by law to be printed in the voter's pamphlet. And I think if an individual can gain nominations from a number of parties, that ought to be useful information to the voting public. And I think it also demonstrates that that particular candidate has a certain appeal broadly out there, and the people should have the opportunity to know that. And basically that's what this bill does. We call this bill Fusion because it allows a candidate, again, to have listed in the voter's pamphlet the number of parties that have, in fact, given him their or her their nomination. So, Mr. Chairman, I ask that you would pass this bill out so that we can have the debate on the floor and move it to the Senate side.
Any questions of Representative Krupp?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
And let me start by saying that I, too, enjoyed the nomination from both of the major parties in the last election, the Republican and the Democratic nomination, and yet was listed only as the Democratic nominee. My question is this. How is the order of the parties listed determined under this bill? I can't tell for sure. Would it be the option of the candidate who accepts the that listing, or is it does somebody in the elections office decide in what order the political supporters would be listed?
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask that Richard Burke, Chairman of the Libertarian Party, join me. I want to make sure that we say the same thing here.
Well, Richard Burke's there, and then Teresa, is it Bellis? Bellis?
I'm not speaking.
Okay. If you'd like to come up, Richard, that'd be fine.
It's a great question, Mr. Chairman and Representative McPherson. It's one of those technical things we probably should pay attention to.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, members of the committee, on the back of the bill, in paragraph F, it says, for a candidate...
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. For the record, my name is Richard Burke. I'm Executive Director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon. It says, for a candidate who is nominated by a political party of which the candidate is a member, and by any political party or parties of which the candidate is not a member, the name of the political party of which the candidate is a member, and the name of each other political party selected by the candidate shall be added opposite the name of the candidate. So the first thing that is noted is that the party that the candidate belongs to will be listed. Then the parties... any other parties would be listed if they are selected by the candidate. So if, for example, the Libertarian Party decided to nominate a Democrat, Joe Smith, and the Democrat said, well, I appreciate the gesture, but I don't think that helps me in this particular district. I'm going to refuse this nomination, then the Libertarian name would not appear next to that candidate's name. But if another candidate said, in my district, I think it's a plus, then they would say okay. And so the beauty of this bill is that it gives everybody more options. It gives candidates more options, and it gives political parties more options, but it doesn't force anyone to do anything. It doesn't force political parties to cross-nominate, and it doesn't force candidates to accept cross-nominations. It just provides choices, which I think can do a lot to change the culture of partisanship that so many have complained about. And I think I've spoken with all of you on this bill at one time or another. It has broad support, bipartisan support in both houses, and it is a bill that I think is good for democracy, and as I put up top, good bill should pass.
If I could pursue a particular question, and it is that if I'm reading this language, I think it could be construed in F on the second page, that if I'm the Democratic nominee, that is, I filed as a Democratic candidate and I won that nomination in the primary, then the Democratic Party would be the first name, I think, if I'm reading that, because it does
say... That's how I read it. If you're a Democrat... Yes.
They say that each other party shall be added opposite, so that suggests that the initial name is the party that of which the candidate is a registered member. But let's say that I was such a consensus figure that I was able to get both the Republican and Libertarian nominations as well. My question is, which order would they appear? And it looks to me like this doesn't tell us. And how would that be decided? Whether it would say Democratic or Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, or would say Democrat, Libertarian, Republican. I mean, maybe it's a minor matter, but I'm curious.
Well, Representative McPherson, members of the committee.
Going to win the election anyway.
That's right.
What are you doing?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee. This actually happens in New York State, where there have been candidates who get 5-6 nominations. And what they have experienced is that this is taken care of administratively. It is done either alphabetically or it is done in the order in which the paperwork came in. That is something that is the decision is made at an administrative level. And I would submit to you that such a decision could be made at an administrative level under these circumstances, too.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I'm fine with that, and the only thing I would want to make sure is clear, and I think it is well understood that it is the party of the candidate's registration that always would appear first.
Okay, any other discussion on the bill?
I'd just like to say I support it, too. I think it's a good idea. Time has come to do this.
Okay, is motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, before you close, let me for the record.
You keep talking.
Yes, I know.
No, you can't vote against it. You signed on it, buddy.
The thing is, if I don't punch it out with the gavel, it doesn't ever get there to vote on.
I was referring to your vice chair, Mr. Chairman, not you.
Keep digging, Jack.
Well, one of the really great benefits of doing this is that it offers an opportunity, as Richard said, for candidates to go to other parties and have an opportunity to have dialogue with them when they think that there is where that's really appropriate. For instance, I am have friends in the Libertarian Party. I would not mind going to their convention and having an opportunity to seek their nomination. I would not mind going to the Constitution Party convention and seeking their nomination. No offense to my Democratic brothers over here. I probably wouldn't show up at the Democrat convention, but who knows? Maybe if you invited me, I might.
We have a big tent.
So there are a lot of ancillary benefits to this, and I think it opens up the process and the dialogue, and I would urge your passage, Representative Boquist.
Chair, I move House Bill 3021 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 3021 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. House Bill 3021 moves to the floor with a due pass. I would assume, Representative Kropp, you'd like to carry?
I would be honored only if you would assign Representative Boquist to join me.
That's great. Co-carry.
Be delighted for the record, but sure, I too could have had two more endorsements on mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
SR9. Okay, we'll do that. We'll
just SR9.
You can find it. Got to open it.
Yeah.
Isn't this sponsored by somebody?
No. Open a work session, a hearing and work session on SCR 9.
Mr. Chair and Committee, SCR 9 memorializes life and public service of H. Clay Myers, 1927 through 2004. Clay Myers served two terms as Oregon Secretary of State beginning in 1967 and two terms as State Treasurer beginning in 1976. Myers was a popular politician, credited with ability to reach out to and represent all people in the state. As a college student at the University of Oregon, Myers founded the Young Republicans Group. He continued his organizational efforts as a leader in the area of voting rights. Myers attended the Coast Guard Academy and earned a law degree from Northwest College of Law. In the early 1960s, he was instrumental in launching the political career of Tom McCall. He achieved his own political success as Secretary of State and State Treasurer, contributing to the lasting conservation programs, the enacting of the Oregon Beach Law, the nation's first statewide land use planning program, the adoption of the Bottle Bill, and the creation of statewide bikeway system. Myers was also a natural leader of the Episcopal Church, where he worked to gain equality for women and to open the church to all, regardless of sexual orientation. Myers is remembered as a part of the core of innovation, open-minded state leaders who worked with members of both major parties to develop sound policies for the state of Oregon.
Have a motion on the bill.
I have, Mr. Chair, I move SCR 9 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay, Representative Barker has moved SCR 9 to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion?
Adopt.
Well, just, Mr. Chair, just to say that I'm quite an admirer of Clay Myers, and that he was a political ally of an older generation of my family, and I'm honored to participate in supporting him in this way.
Okay. Anything further? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
SCR 9 has been adopted, and Representative McPherson, would you like to carry it?
Please do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open a work session and then Senate Bill 45A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 45A allows the Department of Environmental Quality to issue individual, general, or watershed water pollution discharge permits. It also requires DEQ to report annually to the legislature on the administrative permitting process, and it also allows DEQ to increase the fees for certain permits by a maximum of 3% per year. Mr. Chair, you will notice attached to your staff measure summary that there is a fiscal impact statement on the Angros bill. It basically gives you an estimate of what the 3% per year fee increase would be for the 0507 biennium and the 0709 biennium. Mr. Chair, this has a subsequent referral to budget. Also, you have, I believe, some testimony from Associated Oregon Industries and the Northwest Pulp and Paper in support of Senate Bill 45A engrossed in your materials also.
Okay, thank you. Ms. McCauley and Catherine Van Anna, please first.
For the record, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Jim McCauley, representing Department of Environmental Quality, Water Quality Division. I want to make my comments very brief in the interest of what remains on your calendar for the day. Senate Bill 45 remains DEQ's priority package for this year in terms of its legislative package. There is a policy package that goes along with this, Policy Package 120. And has been included both in both versions that have been voted out of both the House and the Senate. It is a package that is going to be instituting programmatic improvements in our wastewater treatment program to make sure we are efficiently and effectively instituting that program. There was going to be the ability to go through our permitting process with a watershed approach, allowing us to take a more holistic look at watersheds and how we approach our wastewater package or our wastewater permitting program within each of those programs. We're going to be able to implement some new accountability standards on behalf of the agency within this program, as well as ensuring some stable ongoing funding that is not only going to improve a sense of stability among the ratepayers out there, but also a sense of some revenue stability for us as an agency as we move through our management. Perhaps the most important element of Senate Bill 45 is that this is the result of approximately 18 months worth of public advisory committee process. The committee is known as the Blue Ribbon Committee, represented a cross-section of our ratepayers as well as environmental organizations came to the table during that time frame and offered a full set of recommendations that are included both in, again, Senate Bill 45 as well as our policy package that's part of our overall budget. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and offer to answer any questions you may have.
Catherine?
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, and a 18-month member of the Blue Ribbon Committee, which actually it's been over 2 years since we started that process. The Northwest Pulp and Paper Association supports Senate Bill 45. If you look at the bill and the whereas clauses, you will get the policy implications of what we spent our time doing. The association also supports the fee increases that will be part of this package. In the next 2 years, 11% alone, and then we have an inflation factor ability to raise fees each year to keep up with inflation, hopefully to solve the problem of funding the wastewater permit program into the future. I would call your attention to the third point of my first page of my testimony, which says that an appropriately funded program allows management employees at DEQ to focus on their policy work and long-range plans for improving the program. I think that this is a key component of this package and something that it's time for Oregon to do. We urge your support. Thank you.
Any questions, committee? What are you doing? Convinced easy. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Linda Ludwig and Matt Blevins, please. Might even let you come up, John, if you want.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. I'll be very, very brief. I just want to let you know that the League of Oregon Cities was a participant in the Blue Ribbon Committee process. We very much support the permit streamlining that is part of this package that is extremely, extremely important to cities. I'd also like to let you know that the Community Development Forum, a group of state agency directors and members of the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, Special Districts Association, and the Ports Association, also support Senate Bill 45, the package here today.
Okay. Matt? For the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. OEC was also a member of the Blue Ribbon Committee, and we stand here in full support of this package. We feel like this helps the department to take a good step towards dealing with a problem that we have continued to raise in terms of the backlog of permits that we see in the state, and this takes a good step in terms of getting us on track to helping to clean up the water that, that we have across the state. So we would urge the committee to move this package forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I'll be even briefer, I think. We were also on the Blue Ribbon Committee. It's an excellent package in front of you. We commend it to you. The home builders support it wholeheartedly and would also commend this process to other state agencies dealing with controversial and difficult issues such as what DEQ had in front of it with water quality.
Okay, committee members, do you have any questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 45 to the Budget Committee with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Volquist has moved Senate Bill 45. I guess it has a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee by prior reference. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Richard Barker.
Aye.
Richard Volquist.
Aye.
Richard Torrey.
Aye.
Richard McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Senate Bill 45 moves to the Budget Committee. And who do we need to carry?
We don't need to carry. Got to refer.
I'd like the only committee going. Open a work session on Senate Bill 199A.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 199A comes to you from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The bill has to do with protective orders in criminal cases involving sexual offenses. The current law is 135873, and it gives the court general discretion to enter a protective order in a criminal case at the request of any party upon a showing of good cause that there is reason to restrict disclosure or prohibit the disclosure of the information. This measure would add a specific section to that statute that would require the court to enter a protective order if requested by either the prosecutor or by the alleged victim of the offense. It would only apply in cases involving a sexual offense or an offense involving the visual or audio recording of sexual conduct by children or an offense involving invasion of personal privacy. Two categories of disclosure here. One is an absolute prohibition on the disclosure of information of a sexually explicit nature, information of the prior sexual history of the alleged victim, or the recording of the alleged victimization of the alleged victim. The other category of prohibition is no disclosure unless a showing of good cause, and that applies to a recording of the victim, alleged victim, describing their alleged victimization. There are some exceptions to this statute that includes things like providing discovery, providing information to grand jury or other law enforcement purposes, providing information to experts. There's also a provision that if the alleged victim requests a copy of any of this information that's subject to the protective order, the court must comply. And then finally, the other thing that makes this measure unique from the other sort of general protective order is that once the order is issued, the court cannot unseal the record. The record remains permanently sealed. No amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. How about Phyllis Burkhurst, Paul Brigitte, and Ronell Shank? Look at y'all to come up together, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, legislative liaison to the Attorney General, and I would like to offer our sincere thanks to the committee for hearing this bill at this late date. As your counsel has told you, this is a bill before you from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force.
You have my written testimony. I'm not going to take you through it, but in the interest of telling a new committee, for those of you that don't know me, the Attorney General does have this task force. It was based on activities, as you will see in the testimony, that began seriously in 1999. It has been operating for some time. You have a list of the mission of our task force, and you also have a list of the activities of the task force in my written testimony. As you will see, one of the things that we look at are ways to improve this area of law, and that's why this bill is before you today. I'll then turn it over to Phyllis Barkhurst, the Executive Director, who will tell you a little bit about the background of why this is before you, and then we'll circle back and tell you briefly about the compromise amendments that were done in the first chamber.
Thank you. Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Phyllis Barkhurst. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. One of our jobs and roles is to look and listen to problems that come out from around the state that relate to victims of sexual assault and victimization issues. We're a group that has monitored the Rape Shield Law, for instance, and this law comes to being in response to specific issues that came from different counties, including a couple cases in Coos County, where I'll give you a few examples where pictures of genitalia that was taken for purposes of investigation in a sexual assault case became part of a record and people had access to that, where a sex offender who videotaped the act of the sexual abuse got access to a videotape and would use that for his own pleasuring purposes later on, and for also for offenders who've been able to get access to videotapes of the victims telling their story, which they also use for personal purposes. We want to make sure that if there's no reason for pictures and or graphic depictions about victims to become public knowledge, which also becomes part of the media world, that if there's no reason for that to occur, that victims are protected from that. So this law is drafted to try to increase the protection of child, adolescent, and adult victims of sexual assault crimes and sexual exploitation, and to increase the protections for them and the court's ability to do that.
Circling back, if I might, then the compromise amendments, which your counsel has explained to you very well, I will just share with you. We did work with members of not only our department and the Sexual Assault Task Force, but also the Oregon Alliance to End Violence, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We do have District Attorney Paul Burgett with us here today. In case there are any technical questions, we can defer to him. But we also took it to the ODAA Legislative Committee, and the ACLU has reviewed this. So the compromise amendments that were all worked out in the first chamber, a lot of work was put into it, and I think it's an important balance between still being able to do a good job of prosecution as well as defense on these cases while everyone is still looking out for the victims and not further traumatizing them. Thank you.
Okay. Paul?
Chair Krieger, I'm just here in case you have any questions. I'm happy to be here. And appreciate you listening.
I'm going to get off the coast for a couple days.
A little vacation for me.
He's one of my DAs down on the coast. Committee members, do you have any questions on the bill? Representative McPherson, you got the look this morning.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. I just a technical wording thing. I just want to understand. When I look at sections 5 and 6 of the new ORS 135, or amended 135873, I see that under sub 5, there's no court override. It's the court can find good cause to do otherwise for 6,
right.
Which is the visual or audio recording of the victim's sexual victimization. But in 5, the court doesn't have any power of override. And I'm just curious as to either from counsel or from the panel as to why that distinction between the two provisions.
You can't.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I was whispering to the chair, I can't answer that. And when you finished your question, I said, oh, I can't answer that. the first question, I think it was clarifying that there are two different provisions, and that is true. The first sub 5 is the absolute disclosure, and it lists that category, information of a sexually explicit nature, prior sexual history, and the recording of the alleged victimization. And that there is no court override. And then the second category, section 6, sub 6 rather, is a court-ordered override if the court finds good cause, and that provides the visual or audio recording of the victim describing the victim's sexual victimization. I think that what that is referring to is, an investigative or interview, a clinical interview of the victim. The part I can't answer that I'm sure the witnesses can is the policy distinction between those two and why there's good cause for one and no override for the other.
Right. So.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson. That was really...
Is your name for the record?
Pardon me? Well, I'm sorry. I'm Paul Burgett, Coos County DA and member of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. That was part of the compromise that came about, and I think the rationale is when you're talking about an actual depiction, for example, suppose you had a videotape with minors engaging in sex acts with an adult, there would be an absolute prohibition on that being disseminated, and I think the thought is that that's a much more would be an egregious and difficult thing to justify. Nobody on ACLU, nobody could figure out any reason why we'd want that to be disseminated. A child's verbalization of what happened to them, it may be that might be something that would be subject to challenge, and there might be real controversy. And even in that case, it was hard for us to come up with any scenarios where the court, where judicial discretion would make a big difference. But looking at it from the most egregious point of view, and thinking, there might possibly be some situation where the public would want to know about that, and the public should know about it. For example, if there are inconsistencies in the kid's statement from something that could be shown elsewhere, that might be a matter of public import that should have a public airing. But certainly the actual pictures themselves and so forth, the thought was that there's no reason that anybody ever would need to see those. And most of those things you have to understand are in a criminal investigation. The government's going to go out gathering information. The government and defense attorneys paid by the government oftentimes are going to be gathering this information. So we're creating this body of information that can be very inflammatory and upsetting to a victim. And our approach is that we need to be really careful about then what happens to it. We can't just willy-nilly allow it to get out into the public domain.
Chair Krieger, if I might be quite blunt, Representative McPherson is quite astute. You zeroed in on exactly the compromise amendment. Separating those two subsections is what we spent most of our time working on, and the reality is, depending on if you're in the prosecution or the defense, some of this evidence is more useful than other, and so we gave the court's discretion where it was necessary. The bill started out with no discretion. We've put this level in, and everyone was pleased with that.
Okay.
Mr. Lurie?
Thank you, Chair Krieger. And Representative McPherson, as I was reviewing the rest of the bill, I would just note that from a big picture standpoint, when we're talking about this, what we're talking about really is publication or disclosure to a third party or to the public. And you'll note that sub 7 contains the exceptions with respect to the parties to the case. And that also goes to the compromise amendment on the Senate side. No matter which category the information fits into, the exceptions noted in sub 7 would apply with respect to providing discovery to the parties or information to other law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, and this isn't really a question, Mr. Chair, but if I could venture, I like the compromise that was struck here, because it does seem to me that a statement by the victim describing what happened to them, could be less invasive, not necessarily is, but could be, and that there's I like having the court allow discretion to be a little bit freer with that information than it would be the other information.
Okay, any further discussion? Have a motion on
it? Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 199A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 199A to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative
Gilchrist.
Aye.
Representative
Lurie.
Aye.
Representative
Harrington.
Aye.
Chair Krieger. Aye. Senate Bill 199A moves before the due pass. Representative Barker, would you carry, please?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who's doing this one, Bill? Don't tell me you're going to come and do some work today. Open a work session on Senate Bill 806A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 806A comes to you from Senator George, and what it does includes a private nonprofit organization providing transportation services within the definition of public body and thus capping their liability under the Oregon's Tort Claim Act. To meet this requirement, the private nonprofit organization providing transportation services must receive more than 50% of its funding for transportation services in the state of Oregon or political subdivision, and it only extends the state's tort claim limitations for the providing of public transportation services. So if the nonprofit were providing other services and had a claim against it, it would not have its liability capped for those services. No amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We had this bill before us on June 14th for a public hearing, and we had two witnesses at that time, and we had a sign-up sheet. No one signed up. And the two witnesses spoke in favor of the bill.
Okay, have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
President Barker.
Aye.
President
Boquist.
Aye.
President
Flores.
Aye.
President
Pearson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 806A moves the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Can I?
Representative McPherson, do you feel comfortable carrying this?
Sure. I'd be happy to.
I think we have completed our work. We'll have to get more bills in one day. Yeah, we can find more time of it. Yeah. Okay, thank you for your attendance, and be ready for tomorrow.